organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Seven minutes after the hour of 5. That's right, I'm back. Once again, on top of the drive home at 5. Broke out of Columbian Presbyterian Hospital last night with the IV still in my arm. And I'm 7 days out from going under the knife. Not for a bris. No. Not for a bris. But to deal with this Crohn's disease, which for many years people assumed was genetic to Jews. Oh, no. It's affected many, many Gentiles. Well, we'll be talking about that as we work our way towards next Wednesday, in which I go under the knife. Well, what a gavon you are. You know, Brian Mangalucci, you play as the start of this segment about Trump moving our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. A Satmar song, right? This is a song I recorded long ago at one of the Teitelbaum's weddings in Williamsburg. The Satmars hate the state of Israel. What is wrong with you? You're a total gavon. But let's go to the president of the United States, who earlier today said he was living up to a campaign promise that he made that other presidential candidates had. But when they got elected into office, they just didn't deliver.
After more than two decades of waivers, we are no closer to a lasting peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. It would be folly to assume that repeating the exact same formula would now produce a different or better result. Therefore, I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
And he continued on.
This decision is not intended in any way to reflect a departure from our strong commitment to facilitate a lasting peace agreement. There will, of course, be disagreement and dissent regarding this announcement. But we are confident that ultimately, as we work through these disagreements, we will arrive at a peace and a place far greater in understanding and cooperation.
Duck, there will be another intifada, rock-throwing Palestinians, I guarantee you. But it doesn't seem to be perturbing the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi, who is on board.
We're profoundly grateful for the President for his courageous and just decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and to prepare for the opening of the U.S. Embassy here. This decision reflects the President's commitment to an ancient but enduring truth, to fulfilling his promises, and to advancing peace.
And then, in fact, she was thought of as being the, kept woman of former Secretary of State James Baker and the Bush 41 administration, and then eventually Secretary of State Kerry. Hanan Ashwari, Palestinian leader, weighed in on this.
It's not easy to see everything you have worked for all your life to achieve peace being destroyed by one statement, by one man. This is incredible. It's unconscionable.
On the line to discuss what Donald Trump announced earlier today is Gersh Kuntzman. He is the breaking news editor at Newsweek. Thanks for joining us again here on the Drive Home at 5, Gersh.
Well, Curtis, it's always a pleasure to inject some sense to your discussion, so I'm glad to be here.
Hey, I bet you when you were growing up following the various intifadas, I don't know whose side you were on, you thought that Hanan Ashrari was hot, right? Like Kerry and James Baker did, right? Right, didn't you?
I'm certainly not going to address that, and I'm certainly someone who has followed many intifadas, and I am always on the side of peace, Curtis. You know that about me.
Well, now that the president wants to move our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, are you ready to finally do Aliyah?
Aliyah, yeah. No, I'm not ready to do that. Look, Curtis, this move, as you know, was mandated by Congress more than 20 years ago. All administrations since then, Republican and Democrats, have avoided this move. So I'm not going to blame the president for what he's doing, and I'm not going to say he's doing the wrong thing. What I will say is there's no reason to do this, and he knows it will inflame tensions across the Middle East for no reason. That's the part I don't really understand. You can do it to stick a finger in the eye of the Middle East and the Arabs and the peace process if you want, but there's no actual timely reason to do this now.
Now, when do you think the Pally Boys along Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn are going to start throwing rocks because of this?
Well, I actually don't think any violence will occur here in New York City. I really don't. New York is, as you know, a place where Pakistanis and Indians live next to each other, Bangladeshis and Indians live next to each other, Russians and Ukrainians live next to each other, and even I live near you, Curtis, and I would never get into a fight with anybody on the street, nor would any New Yorker. But I do think there will be violence across the world, and I think it's totally unnecessary. Now, is it wrong to commit violence in the name of your people? Yes, of course it is. But that doesn't mean it was right for President Trump to do this now.
Oh, that was such a great kumbaya moment of yours, Gersh Kunstman. It really warmed the cuddles of my heart.
Well, I would love to warm any part of your body, Curtis, if I can.
Anyway, it appears that your guy, Al Franken, will be resigning tomorrow from the U.S. Senate, as now 30 senators are stacked up against him and say it's time to go. With Conyers and Franken going, since they're both strong Democrat, liberal progressives, what does this say to you?
Well, first of all, how did Al Franken become my guy? Just a point of information.
How did he become your guy? Well, he's a Democrat, liberal, progressive, right? I mean, he represents a lot of the values that you've had, Gersh. I mean,
he represents almost all of my values except for groping women, which I have never done and will go on record as saying that. I'm appalled by Al Franken's behavior. I do think he should resign given the latest accusations. I also think Conyers should resign. I also think Roy Moore should not be elected. I also think President Trump should be clear and come clean about his past. We're having a national discussion on this, and a lot of our sacred cows are going to be slaughtered, including Al Franken.
Now, do you think it's time for your hero, Jay-Z, that degenerate hip-hop monster from the Marcy Avenue Projects, to condemn his business partner, Harvey Weinstein, which he refuses to do?
Of course it is something he should do. I don't know how he became my man as well. Nonetheless, as I'm saying, it's a national reckoning we're going through right now, and everybody needs to be called to account.
Now, that means no judge, no jury, just allegations can just sack your career. You're just down for the count.
No, that's not a good thing. And there is a certain witch hunt quality to this because, as you know, what the allegations against Harvey Weinstein are extremely serious, including rape and continued years of sexual harassment and abuse. Groping certainly does not fall into that category. Alleged groping and even unproven things don't fall to that category. However, the fact that Franken appears to be resigning, the fact that Conyers did resign, speak to a larger truth, which is the allegations are true and I need to get out of here.
Okay, so why over all these years, and this includes a front page story in the Old Gray Lady, the New York Times today, that suggests that Hillary Rodham Clinton was given a heads up as to how pervish Harvey Weinstein, her friend and donor, was. Why do you think it's taken this moment? What were these officials doing all these years when they were aware of the allegations and, in fact, were aware of the evidence against these perverts and these predators?
Well, it goes back a lot longer, obviously, than even just these Harvey Weinstein Me Too revelations. Obviously, Anita Hill testified on the to the Congress about what allegedly Clarence Thomas had done to her. And that started a national conversation, which unfortunately didn't go far enough because the vastly white and male-dominated Senate didn't do anything at that time. Maybe that could have started a national discussion. Maybe Bill Clinton's, whatever you want to call it, maybe Bill Clinton's shenanigans or worse should have started a broader national conversation, but it did not. We're in a highly partisan and supercharged moment as we were during the Clinton impeachment era, and I think that unfortunately, instead of fighting for the rights of women to not be abused, we end up in our own camps fighting about the political ramifications of the men who did this. Look, in all cases across every industry, men are doing this to women. They need to be called to account and replaced with people who don't do this to women. Once that happens, we can address the political ramifications of it.
Now, Gersh Kunstman, you are aware that in those Anita Hill hearings chaired by then U.S. Senator Joe Biden, we learned two interesting facts. One was that Thomas's name at Yale University was Long Dong Silver. That was his nickname. And that he was known for having pubic hair on his Coke can. You were aware of that, right?
I was not aware of either of those from firsthand experience, but I do know that's what she testified.
Yeah, and look, didn't that sort of open up the Pandora's box?
It should have. It should have. But unfortunately, the Senate did not go far enough. They did not bring in additional witnesses who could have and would have corroborated what Anita Hill said. Had that happened, you might have had a Me Too movement right there because there would have been so many women talking about this.
By the way,
unfortunately, they didn't do that.
By the way, I know, Gersh Kuntzman, your favorite radio station is WNYC, right? You know,
I don't know about that. I'm on WABC right now.
I know, but let's be honest, right? You listen to your two favorite hosts there at WNYC, Brian Lehr and Lenny Lopate. Be honest with me, right?
I am a Brian Lehr fan. I appreciate good journalism.
Okay, well, guess what? Your pal Lenny Lopate, he's off the airwaves. He's a perv. He's a sexual marauder, huh? You're going to be listening to that station now, huh?
Well, if the allegations are true and he is off the station, I applaud NYC for moving quickly.
Oh, boy.
I don't know why you're accusing me of being a supporter of these guys over the years when, in fact, I'm not and don't know these people personally.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because you who throw nickels around like manhole covers, I've looked at the recent donations to WNYC, you know, listener-sponsored station that it is, and I see you're a big macher, a big contributor, lots of shekels, huh, to WNYC and to that perv Lenny Lopate, huh?
That would be inaccurate information.
Anyway, Gersh Kuntzman, breaking news editor at Newsweek, would not acknowledge he's a WNYC fan and that WABC is generally not his place to be.
Deep connections, deep understanding.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
He's a man of the people.
77 WABC.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople, been a long time gone.
Very confusing.
Constantinople still
yeah, what
Turkish
is it?
Delight.
The Archbishop of the Greek
night.
Orthodox Church is in Constantinople, which is in Turkey, although there are very few Greek Orthodox there. I mean, when you look at that part of the world, it's fractured, and there are so many chasms. But those chasms exist right in our backyard in what I call the sixth borough of the city of New York, the Poconos, where many civil servants of the city end up taking the bus at the Port Authority each day, pounding the hound 2 hours to go back to because they got a nice house, a little hacienda. But Paul Molshine of the New York Star Ledger was on the case looking for Turkish Imam Fethullah Gulen, who, if you listen to Erdogan, the dictator, the crazy guy who leads Turkey, is at the root of all of his problems. Thanks for joining us on the Drive Home at 5 again, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so why were you on the case of trying to find the infamous Fethullah Gulen?
You know, I just got curious. Here's a guy who has a huge network that extends way beyond Turkey, out into the stands and all that, you know? And he's the target, the leading target of the Turkish government. He's living in the Poconos, 10 miles as the crow flies from New Jersey. And he's got this compound. So naturally, you know, just out of curiosity, on Sunday, I drove up there just to see what it looks like. And it's a pretty beautiful area. I got lost trying to find it because they keep it under wraps. And I passed like a little place where the Appalachian Trail cuts through and all these hikers, you know, it's a nice area. They got good restaurants near the ski area. So it was funny. And finally, I found the little place, and one of the neighbors told me it's guarded and all that. So I parked out front and took some pictures. Then this guy comes out in like a, you know, a military, quasi-military suit, and he starts yelling at me. And I, you know, I got talked to the guy, and he gave me the number of a contact from Gulen's spokesman. And that was he called me back the next day, quite an interesting conversation. You know, Gulen seems a lot saner than Erdogan. He seems more conciliatory towards Israel, more of a kind of a capitalist. So he doesn't seem like a bad guy, you know, except for once you get into the Mideast. That's what I was writing about. Who knows who we Americans, are we going to figure out who the bad guys are and good guys are? You know,
but
suckered every time.
Why is it that Erdogan puts all of his problems on this old autokaka who lives in the Poconos? I mean, how can this guy call the shots from the Poconos for everything that goes wrong with Erdogan in Turkey?
Well, he controlled apparently the whole, you know, he has judges there. He's got a giant movement. they're pretty sharp. For example, when the Erdogan people were trying to, not the Erdogan, this is back, the, you know, Turkey up until 99 or 2001 was militantly secular. You weren't allowed to be Muslim. They went out of their way to keep people from agitating because they didn't want to become an Islamic republic. And in those days, Gulen's people and Erdogan's people were allies, and Gulen's people would keep some beer in the fridge and some empties in the trash just in case the state people ever came by to make sure that they were, you know, not Muslims. Another thing I read was they were having a party and they wanted to see if the Gulenists would have their wives come in bikinis because, you know, the Muslims are against that. But then they went out of their way to wear the skimpiest bikinis. They're pretty sharp. And eventually, of course, they overthrew the secular government. And now, at that point, the one Muslim started fighting the other Muslim. And it's not good for the United States. And here's the craziest thing. This guy Flynn, right, was on the pad for the Turkish government. And he had this wacky James Bond idea, you know, the Army General Flynn, the guy who's in the center of all the trouble in Washington. He was going to snatch Gulen, which when you go to the place, you go, that's crazy. It's a blocked off compound. What were they going to do? Fly in a helicopter and grab this like 76-year-old guy and spirit him out? I mean, it just shows you how silly Americans are to think they could do something like that.
Do you believe that allegation that Lieutenant General Flynn was prepared for a lot of money to kidnap Gulen and return him to Erdogan's prisons and gulags?
That is what has been attributed to Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director who was recruited into the firm. Now, he said they never got into a serious planning part, but I've spoken to Woolsey. He's a relatively sane guy. Haven't spoken to him recently. But that seemed to be part of it. It's something they were discussing.
Now,
the other thing,
yes.
You know, I imagine he would also say, oh, I'm friends with Donald. I'll have Donald just extradite him, which could have really happened. That's the sort of thing that's more in the realm of possibility.
Now, in your travels there to find this infamous Imam Gulen, was he ever seen taking one of those champagne baths at the Mount Airy Lodge and shooting dice at the casinos there?
He doesn't ever leave the premises. There was a nice winery by there I saw that was quite nice. And then there was an Indian place, like Indian, with like a little Taj Mahal, you know, where they go. So it's quite a, become quite a cosmopolitan district there.
Well, do appreciate that. That's Gumshoe columnist for the New York Star Letter, Paul Molshine.
Curtis Sliwa, the deepest knowledge of the city.
You'll be the next mayor of the city of New York.
The Drive at 5, 77 WABC.
Hey, jingity jing. It's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing. The Italian Christmas donkey. La, la, la.
This should be Bill Ervolino's theme song whenever we have him on from the record in New Jersey. Bill, thanks for joining us again. But you like that theme song?
Yeah, I love it. Thanks a lot.
Did you grow up with that in your household?
I grew up with Peppino the Italian Mouse. Why don't you give me a little of that?
Wait. Topo Gigio, you remember, on Ed Sullivan.
No, I grew up in an Italian Jewish neighborhood, Rosedale, Queens. And I remember when the Jewish holidays came, the Jews had a fast. They would be ashen. They would walk around. They couldn't breathe. Italians have to fast. It's the biggest meal of the year. Because, you know, the fish on Friday was a fast day, and we would have, you know, my brother would sit at the table and go, oh, can I have a hot dog? And my mother would say, we're suffering, you know, eat your lobster tails. And you know, Christmas Eve is the big kahuna of fish feasts, and they call it the Feast of the Seven Fishes. We had eight. I don't know about you.
Oh, no. Seven. By the way, we also added anchovies, just to piss some people off who loathe anchovies.
I love anchovies.
But did you ever have to go low budget because, you know, you didn't have much coin in the household, and then your mother was serving up Mrs. Paul's fish sticks?
No, never. Are you kidding me?
I don't know. You know,
get out of here.
Sometimes Times are pretty hard, you know, Bill.
No. Now, you know, but there's a serious issue to this because I wonder, first of all, if today's kids, I hate to sound like the old man on the corner, are they really concerned about these traditions at all? Because I really grew up with this instilled in me, that this dinner that we would have every Christmas Eve would have, you know, has been going back for centuries, that my mother's family was making it, her grandmother, grandmother. They all were making this meal, which was delicious and still is. But every year it seems like another thing gets thrown out the window. It's too much work. And the kids, I don't think they really care.
Now, was your favorite the bacala, the scungili?
I liked all of it. I liked the bacala because my mother would make it as a salad with black olives, vinegar peppers, celery leaves, her own little concoction. And, you know, you like what you grew up with. And that salad meant the world to me. And I would eat it every year. And nobody else was eating it. She wanted to cut it out one year. I called her the fish Nazi. No bacala for you. I was like, what are you doing to me? Are you a bacala fan?
Oh, absolutely. The salted cod. Because remember, that's one thing that it has in common with my Polish side.
Yeah.
The Poles love codfish. In fact, right before Easter, they'll go out, get live codfish, and they'll be swimming right in their bathtub next to their toilet.
I thought it was the same meal. You know, one day I confronted my mother about this. I said, this is the same meal. She goes, well, there was something else. They used to have eels in the bathtub for like 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I was like, oh, because I love eel. I know eel only from sushi restaurants because my mother never made it. She hated it. But that was the one thing that she dropped out. She got rid of that. I guess she replaced it with something else. The Portuguese have great, if you go up to Cape Cod or whatever, they have all these great, cod dishes also with, and a lot of it is with tomato sauce and stuff. Did you have it that way? Or did you have it cold? How did you eat it?
No, I had it cold. The bacala had it cold as part of that salad that you discussed, but also the scungili salad, you know, the sea snails.
Yes. Scungili, calamari. I hate pronouncing them the American way, but that's what I do now. Calamari. And smelts, which also got dropped out, flounder,
yes,
shrimps, and yep, we would have spaghetti with crab sauce. What was your spaghetti dish?
My spaghetti dish, it was always macaroni with gravy. It was always ronzoni sonoboni with gravy. But particularly on the night of the seven fishes, you would have to have that not with a red sauce, because that was considered udiscrazia. You'd have to have it with the seafood sauce.
The white sauce. Which she made as a red sauce, a very sweet, delicious, subtle sauce. Some people have clam sauce and other things. Oh, by the way, you know, after I wrote this thing, someone told me that her mother, she would make the bacala every year, quote unquote, and it wasn't really bacala. She had gotten this pollock that was already cleaned and, shredded or whatever they do to it. And she had made the salad with that, and she said nobody even noticed. I've never tried this.
Ah, so she did a little switcheroony.
Well, you know, this is someone, you know, a reader's mother. My mother never did that. She did the soaking and, you know, whatever. But because, you when you go to the store, it's like a canoe paddle. It's like this big thing. It's like hard as a rock, and you got to keep soaking it and changing the water and so on and so forth.
But now, since your mother has passed, what do you do to maintain the tradition, Bill Irvine?
Well, because my mother was slowing down the last few years, so my sister-in-law, Joyce, she kind of got into the ball game. But the first year, I caught her just in time. She was going to make the flounder with Italian breadcrumbs, which we did not put on fish.
Oh, Progresso breadcrumbs, right?
We would use the plain breadcrumbs because you don't want cheese on a delicate fish flavor, whatever. And so I stopped her from that. My mom also used to make the shrimps with breadcrumbs, half of them, fry them, and half with flour, which I prefer.
Oh, man.
And my favorite breakfast was all of this fish cold, with lemon and a glass of milk. That's what I had for breakfast, like, growing up. That's why I'm still here.
Who ever say? You used to have all the fish cold.
Cold.
With a glass of milk and lemon.
Well, two glasses of milk.
Two glasses of milk.
I was the all-American fish boy,
Now, how did your friends react to that? That you were just so...
When I hear people, especially Italians, tell me they don't like fish, I want to hit them in the head with a cod.
Mm.
Because I don't understand how anybody could not like it, but... For breakfast, no, they were very sickened by the whole thing.
Now, when you were growing up in Rosedale, Queens, though, some of the Jews who were observant, did they say, hey, that's treif, Gentile, that's treif. We can't have lobster, we can't have shrimp, we can't have clams, casino.
First of all, they weren't, you know, shrimp and lobster sauce, I learned that from Jews. I never even knew what it was until my Jewish friends were buying it and eating it. So I think they got into all that treif from the back door with the Chinese restaurant. You know, sometimes we would have Jewish friends over for Christmas Eve, and I like to also spend Jewish holidays with my friends, and just, you know, you learn a little, and I love food, so whatever it is, I'm probably going to eat it unless it's jellyfish or something.
And it was right in front of your Christmas tree? You mean the Jews weren't repelled by that? They didn't say, hey, it's Hashem, not JC.
Well, what are you going to do? I don't know. A few of them had it, and there will always be arguments in the family. They would argue about whether they should get a tree or not. You know, and then but that was it. I don't know. The thing is, you know, they would ask all the time about Christmas, and I'd say, look, for my family, Christmas is not the big thing. Christmas Eve is the big thing.
Yes.
And that's when we would also exchange gifts, and we would eat this enormous fish meal, and it went on and on and on all night.
That's right. Anyway, that's great. Bill Ervolino, you need to check out so many of his columns at NorthJersey.com. He writes for The Record. And in advance of Christmas Eve, the Italian tradition, the night of the seven fishes. And if you really want to stick it to your family, serve it with anchovies, right? It'll turn off one-third of the people who are sitting at the table. That means more fish for you to eat.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
Guardian Angel found a Curtis Sliwa.
Really trying to help our cause.
WABCRadio.com.
As we continue here on the drive home at 5:00, I used to hear the Chipmunk Christmas song on the old WABC when they used to spin stacks of wax top 40 in the 60s. But now, Bob Brown's Christmas extravaganza.
The Neiman Marcus catalog has just about everything anyone would want for their fantasy gift. Mimi Sterling is Vice President of Corporate Communications.
Our most expensive gift this year is our New Year's Eve celebration package.
How much?
$1.6 million. It's in partnership with the Knickerbocker Hotel in New York City, the heart of Times Square. The idea is for you and 299 of your closest friends and family, you'll spend two nights at the Knickerbocker, 150 hotel rooms, and you will have a rooftop elevated experience at eye level with the cool ball that drops to ring in the new year. It's really an experience like none other.
How about something a little more international?
For $300,000, you and a guest can go experience parts of Africa with the jewelry designer Stephen Webster. It's first-class airfare for two to Johannesburg. Then you'll go to the Kagan Mines, which is in Zambia. And you will discover how they're mining these beautiful emeralds. And you come home with a 7.2-carat emerald that you will design a unique jewelry piece in conjunction with Stephen Webster when you go back to his workshop in London.
And since little girls love dolls,
an $8,000 dream come true for those little girls in your life. It's a year of Madame Alexander dolls. Basically, on Christmas morning, your special young lady will open up an oversized anniversary edition dollhouse and eight dolls, and then each subsequent month will receive another doll.
Of course, if you're looking for a more practical gift,
another really cool item we're thrilled to offer in limited edition this year is the Dolce & Gabbana refrigerator. In partnership with Smeg, it's an amazing, colorful, beautiful refrigerator, only exclusively available at Neiman Marcus.
How much?
That one's $50,000.
Bob Brown, WABC News.
Wow, Bob, that's going to cost a lot of ducats, a lot of scuttle, a lot of cheddar.